Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone on today's DSSA working group call on Thursday, the 5th of January. We have Poncelet Ilelegi, Mike O'Connor, Andre Thompson, Cheryl Langdon Orr, Scott McCormick, Olivier Crépin-Leblanc, Jacques Latour. From staff, we have Julie Headland, Patrick Jones, and myself, Gisela Gruber. We have several people who are on the Adobe Connect room. I will read out their names as well as they can hear the audio. We have Don Blumenthal, Katrina Sataki, Rosella Mattioli, Takayasu Matsura, and Wim de Hassala. Apologies today noted from Jörg Schweiger and Rafik Damak. If I could also please remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Mikey.
Thanks, Gisela, and welcome all to the DSSA New Year's party, carrying on the tradition. And as always, we'll stop for a minute and let people update us on their statements of interest, if there's been any change to those.
Mikey, Cheryl Langdon-Orr here.
Go ahead.
Not a terribly thrill-packed or exciting change to my SOI, but I am now officially a member of another part of the ICANN community. The non-commercial stakeholders group of the GNSO have accepted me as an individual member.
Wow, congratulations, and welcome to the GNSO.
My pleasure.
It's too bad you're so unfamiliar with everything that goes on in the GNSO.
I'm looking forward to my orientation, yes.
Yeah, I would think so. That time you spent on the council, I'm sure, didn't have anything to do with it. Well, that's great. Congratulations. Any other changes to the statements of interest? All right, then. We're going to jump right back in to the place we left off, which is working our way through the non-adversarial threat sources. And I think we've started to slide into a groove. I'm hoping we can start knocking these off a little bit faster than we were. We were sort of inventing methodology as we went, but I think that we're down to the place where we can just do these over and over again. And so just to replay with the bidding, we've done two of, if you look at this list here, this is our total list of non-adversarial threat sources. We have about, 6 or 8. And what we discovered was that it's really hard to evaluate these without also describing sort of where the threat was taking place, the threat event. And so we're combining them. So we put two of them together, and we have a conversation about any given threat event. In the case that's on the screen, the threat source is a configuration error by a privileged user, and then the event itself is of a privileged user of a lesser zone file or one that's not outsourced to a major provider. And then in that conversation, we talk about two things. We talk about the range of the impact, very sweeping all the way down to very minimal, and we also talk about the likelihood of that impact. And we've done two. We did a major zone file and a lesser zone file, or a lesser zone. We have a couple more to do in this category, the configuration errors by privileged users, and then we have a bunch more types of threats to get through. So we'll see how we do today. I'm hoping that we can get through a number of these. And Cheryl, having no internet access today due to a big storm which knocked out some key piece of infrastructure, gets to vote by voice. For the rest of you, on your screen, there is a little polling area, and we'll just go through and sort of collect our views, review them, try and talk each other into changing our vote, see if we can come fairly close to a consensus view, and then record that and move on. So that's sort of the plan.
Thank you.
On the hit parade today is the root zone. Configuration errors by privileged users of the root zone. And our first item to vote on is the range of impact. If the root zone were to be misconfigured. And with that, go ahead and start putting your votes into the little polling thing. We've got one vote so far. I'm waiting for a few more.
All right, so this is Mark. I'm really going to confuse the issue some.
No, you never do that.
Yeah, I know. Okay. There's two types of configuration errors that actually could occur here. One is configuration errors that are done by each administrator, of which there are 12.
Okay.
And to me, that is limited. That's a limited sort of issue. Now, if it's a configuration error in the root zone itself, then it's sweeping. It's a 10. So there's
okay,
a difference.
So we'll make two. Bits are cheap. So we'll make a root zone, and we'll say, how did you describe that other one? I've got the individual administrator one in there, Mark. What's the other one?
If it's a configuration error in the zone file itself, IANA cuts a zone file that has a mistake in it.
Okay.
Like the NS set is wrong for the Apex.
Yeah, got it. Okay, so I'm going to treat those as two different things.
All right.
I agree. I think those are two different things. And so since people are doing the sweeping in the polling, let's treat this particular conversation as the one that Mark just told us about. This is a configuration error by a privileged user at IANA in the zone that's replicated across all the other servers. And
well, that's a huge. What's my biggest number?
Yeah, that's the off the top. Cheryl, are you on another sweeping one? So
I'm right over the top. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we're going to give that one an 8. That's easy. And then relevance to the organization, which we are now calling likelihood.
How low can I go?
I think you can go to. Our scale goes all the way to 0 on this one.
The ends of the bell curve. Pop me in as a 1.
Okay. I'm going to vote for Cheryl, so that'll make my tallying a little easier. Okay, well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to clear the votes and let you vote again. Hang on a minute, folks. All right. Everybody vote again. I'm voting 0 for Cheryl. There we go. Now we got the votes where we want them. All right. So we've got pretty much everybody except Cheryl, me channeling Cheryl, showing up as a 1. It's described by a somewhat credible source. So we'll give that one 7, and we'll give 0, 1. Good. I like this pace. Now we're going to go on to the one that I originally was doing, which was a root zone by an individual administrator, and we'll do the range of impact. Again, this is the sweeping at 10 all the way to minimal at 1. Wide ranging is 5. 8 is extensive. 3 is limited. Cheryl, where do you want to plunk yourself on that one?
My gut feeling is more in the threes-ish.
All right, you've got good company. I'll put you in a three.
I'm also desperately trying to get my 3G dongle to actually find enough internet to connect me. At the moment, I'm not even getting one bar, but I will continue to try.
It does sound like you had a tough night with that storm. All right, we've got
connection for all the TVs and everything, so maybe things got goofy somewhere else. Anyway.
Well, you could watch TV tonight. You know, instead of us.
I can now, because I can get to the satellite. But.
Yeah. Well, we're almost as good as TV. All right, so now I'm going to do the clear all our votes out. Now we'll do likelihood. And our choices range from pretty darn likely to not so likely. Now this is the likelihood rather than the impact. Where do you want to plunk yourself on this one? This is an individual zone file administrator misconfiguring their file.
Oh, well, what's my range there, Mikey? What's your top number?
Oh, you could be all the way from possible at 1 to predicted at 3, anticipated at 5, expected at 8, and confirmed at 10.
So, Mikey, this is Jim.
Yeah, go ahead.
Calvin, just a question. A root zone misconfiguring their file. In principle, they can't misconfigure the file to the extent that they take what they're given and that's what they publish. I thought this would be about other kinds of operational configuration errors.
Well, actually, Jim, there's two types. One is actually changing something in namd.conf. The other thing is, and this has happened even though root server administrators won't admit to it, is that they will, something happens and they have to get a zone file a different way, and they may even edit it.
Huh. Okay.
So they're not supposed to, but they do.
It has happened in the past.
Okay. Well, then, just to make sure that I understand the question then, so this really is about the zone file and an individual administrator and what they do, and we will talk separately about the operation of zone publication, right?
Correct. I'm making another one as we speak.
Well, because individuals can be flaky and stupid and everything else, can you stick me in a 5?
Yeah. I'm giving you a 5.
And this
actually,
is
we're
Jim again.
I think we're going to have to redo this vote, Cheryl, because we've just changed the ground rule. So hang on for just a minute while I capture the new one that we've done.
And
okay,
this is Jim again,
ahead,
just
Jim.
To comment on one thing that Mark said when he commented about namd.conf. I would consider that still an operational issue, not a file configuration issue with respect to the zone file. If you want to disagree with that, I'd be interested in where you want to draw that line.
Mark, what do you think? I'd love to keep it to one thing rather than two.
I think it's a matter of semantics from my perspective. The root server administrator has administrative control over the entire machine, including the operation of namd. So if they want to change namd.conf or the root zone that they've received from ICANN/IANA, whatever they want to call themselves these days, they can go ahead and do so. Now, whether you call that a system configuration or a root zone configuration, to me it doesn't matter. It's something that the individual root server operator does for their actual system itself.
So, this is Jim again. I agree with you. It's a semantic issue, which I guess is why I sort of pushed the question back, just to sort of hear a little bit of perspective from you. I think the way that I would draw the line is, in principle, an administrator, right, is given a zone file, and in principle, they shouldn't edit that. They should be publishing whatever they get, setting aside the fact that they might do things they're not supposed to or do things that they have to in order to make things work correctly. But everything that they do on behalf of publishing what it is that they get is where I would draw the line, and I would put that on the operational side. And that's why I put named.conf on the other side. I'm drawing that clear distinction between what is under their control, or rather what should be under their control, versus what should not be under their control. Does that help any, or change what you're thinking, or do you agree less, or disagree more with me?
I totally agree. One slide from the Gambia speaking. I totally agree with you.
Oops. So let me play back what I've typed. I'm sort of thinking these are two different kinds of things. One is that an individual administrator changes the zone file, the contents of the zone. I'm going to put that in there. And then parenthetically, I'm saying that's something they shouldn't do. They shouldn't be able to control. And then the other is, so they publish an inaccurate zone file, but they actually publish it, as opposed to the operational stuff where they change something else on their server that means that they no longer publish the zone file at all. How about that for a distinction? Does that help?
Or publish it incorrectly for some reason. This is Jim again.
Yeah. Mark, how do you feel about that distinction?
That's totally fine.
Cool. All right. So we're going to vote on two different things. I think we're going to have to redo our range business. So let's just start from scratch. Sorry, folks, but this is the nature of this kind of work, which is we learn things as we go, and then so we have to repeat just a little bit. That's no big deal. All right, so the first one we're going to do is the range of impact on the one where an individual administrator actually changes and publishes the contents of the zone file, which is something they shouldn't ever do. And so our question here is, I think I may have cleared answers to this one, but go ahead and do it again. So the question here is, what's the impact of that? If a zone file in one of the lettered servers is inaccurately published because an administrator changes it, what's the impact on the DNS? And, you know, this is a question that I, quite frankly, don't know the answer to. If one of the, however many it is now, 12 or 13 zone servers has an inaccurate zone file in it, what happens?
I don't know either.
Do they cross-check each other, or do they... So, if I ultimately wind up at the A server and it's wrong, and everybody else B through whatever it is now is right, who gets impacted? What happens to people doing queries of the DNS?
It depends on a whole bunch of different factors.
Okay.
Location, number of any cast instances, you name it. A typically sees more traffic than the other ones.
Yeah, okay.
But that doesn't...
But if I go to one that's misconfigured, I don't recoil in horror and run off and check a different one.
No.
I just accept it.
Yeah.
So I would just
see the question down. About... So this is Jim Galvin. The question about impact has to have a context. So the context is, you know, what is the effect on the internet, or what is the effect on an individual user? Because on the internet, I would argue that the effect is actually pretty limited. Okay, it depends a little bit, I suppose, on the size of the root server operator. But you know, in principle, it's pretty limited. But from the point of view of a user, it's actually quite sweeping. Because a user typically, by default, is only going to have access to a particular root instance. And if that happens to be the one which has got bad data in it, then they get nothing, or they get all the bad stuff.
Right. Oh, okay. So the answer on this one is it depends, and it depends on which server is the one that went down.
Well, it matters to the user. You know, I mean, the user matters. I mean, from the point of view of an individual root server being rogue or bad or, you know, extraordinary things happening, it only affects a limited user community in principle.
Actually, Jim, it depends on how big the resolver is that caches this and how many – what is the user population behind that resolver?
Okay, so, yeah, trying to stay at a certain level, but, yeah. So maybe Mikey said it best when he said the answer really depends.
Yeah,
I think it depends on how close to the user that you are, and that's how you answer the question. The closer you are to the user, the more sweeping the issue. The further away you are from the user, then the less of an issue it is to the user. Maybe that's the right way to phrase it.
Well, and that gets us to the whole underlying premise of our impact statement, which is what's the impact on the DNS?
Right. So from the point of view of the DNS, I think that the effect is actually – well, no, I guess Mark's point actually comes to bear here too. I mean, at the point of view of the server, I think the effect is limited. But, you know, as Mark is saying, if you start talking about resolvers, which obviously are part of the DNS infrastructure as a whole, then again, it just depends on how big the cache is in that resolver and how many users are tied to it.
Okay. So we're going to – we have a choice at this point. We could expand the threat tree one more layer on this particular one and say that...
So going back to what I said, so this is just Jim again. I really think it the impact statement depends on how close to the user you're talking about. I think that's really the answer. The further away you are from the user... the less sweeping the impact or the less dramatic its effect. The closer you are, the more sweeping it is and the more dramatic the effect.
Okay. So... So if we were to say, see, I think in order for the methodology to work, I'm not sure. I think what I'm going to do is not record the range of impacts for this one, but rather just record that note so that we capture this notion that in this particular instance, we want to say it depends rather than trying to nail that down. The other way to do this would be to actually create two threat events out of this, one that's close to the user and one that's not. But I could see our threat tree then growing sort of infinitely bushy. And I think a better way out of this is just to take note of that. Now, there's a bunch of stuff going on in the chat. Mark kicked it off by saying, one thing I should make clear on this root server's own change is that this has not been done that I've known about for over a decade. And I think that gets to the likelihood issue. And then Jim is saying to Jacques, actually it depends. Oh, Jacques is saying it's 1/13th of the user base, and Jim is responding to that by saying, Jacques, actually it depends on the size of the root server footprint. Not all root servers cover all part of the globe, and some do parts more than others. So to say 1/13th is sort of oversimplifying it a bit. And then there's really only 1/12th since VeriSign runs 2. Okay, I'm thinking that... Okay, let's go on to likelihood, which is getting to Mark's point. Let me clear the... Actually, hang on just a minute, folks. Sorry this is so halting, but I'm sort of inventing as I go. Something I seem to be doing a lot on these calls. All right, so we're going to do the likelihood, which I think then gets to Mark's point. Now you can vote how likely do we think that this situation would arise where an individual administrator actually changes and publishes the contents of a zone file incorrectly. Louise, go ahead.
Yes, Luis Espinosa from .cr. My comment about likelihood is it must take in account the controls in place to be happened. Then if there's many controls in place to avoid this, one of these mistakes or threats, then the likelihood could be lower, should be lower, sorry. But if there's no controls, the likelihood should be higher. My comment is because the likelihood is different, taking into account the controls in place. But I don't know if some of us knows about the controls in place in IANA, for example, about this management of root zones. That's my comment.
Thanks, Luis. And the issue that you raise, which is the quality and capability of the controls that are in place to prevent this, actually shows up a bit later in the methodology. And what we're going to do is evaluate those for each of these. And so I'm pretty confident that we're going to be able to pick that up. But you're right, the tricky thing that we've done by... This is showing up a flaw in what Mikey did to the methodology, in that the likelihood conversation we pulled forward into this part of the conversation because what we were originally trying to do is just identify the range of impact but not the likelihood. But I've pulled a piece of the methodology forward, which I probably shouldn't have done. And so we may want to treat these as preliminary estimates of likelihood to be confirmed later when we come back around to look at the controls around these things. That's a really good point, Louise. Does everybody else follow my tortured logic on that?
Mikey?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, and about the range of impact. I'm talking about the zone file, if there's a discussion about if only one domain is out and this domain have low impact, then there's a difference in the impact in that place. But in my perspective, the sound file must be accurate 100% all the time. Then if the sound file is not accurate 100% all the time, then there's a fail. In that point of view, only one domain out of the sound files or mistaking the sound file, in my point of view, is hidden by the threat in this way. This is my point of view of the sound files.
Right. And in this particular part of the conversation, we're talking about the root zone. So this is the zone file that points to the top-level domains, like .cr, .com, etc. So this is not an individual TLD zone file, nor is it an individual second-level domain, like bar.com. This is the root zone file that we're working
well,
on at this point.
Yes, in this matter is more important to have the 100% of the accuracy of the phone files. If it's not 100%, something failed, and I failed.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely right. Okay, so let's do our likelihood thing on an individual administrator who's changed and published the contents of the root. That's where the confusion. The root zone file. So let's see. Let's go ahead and vote. We have Cheryl. You want your range? Your range is all the way from possible, I suppose, number one, all the way up to confirmed and expected, etc. at 10. It's getting pretty strong support at 1 right now. Everybody's at 1 on this one. You want to join the crowd?
I am going to join the crowd, but I'm also aware that I'm biased by history and perhaps am concerned that that's not really taking into account probability of the risk, just measurement of the risk.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, and this, I think, gets right back to the point that Louise just made, which is that
yep.
Mikey's kind of hosed up the methodology here just a little bit. I have to ponder whether putting likelihood into this conversation. I think we have to do a preliminary version of likelihood this time around.
We need to chew on this, Cheryl, for the transcript record, Mikey. We need to chew on this in particular, because, for example, if malice comes into it, then it's an entirely different answer for me.
Yes. And that's a whole different piece of the threat tree.
Yeah.
What we're doing right now is inadvertent.
Yeah.
If we have a malicious change, then we're in a whole different piece of the threat tree. And
I'm biased by the fact that these things just haven't happened, therefore. But I'm concerned that that might be a complacent answer.
Right. Well, and they have happened, at least according to Mark, but they happened quite some time ago. So I think what we'll do is we'll treat these likelihood assessments as preliminary assessments. But then when we get to the controls part, because we are going to hit controls, we may have to circle back and reevaluate these once we've taken a look at both the controls that are in place and the effectiveness of the organizations at implementing and maintaining those controls. And that said, I think what we'll do is we'll put this preliminary assessment as pretty unlikely. Everybody seems to be in that camp in the voting. Cheryl, are you okay with riding along on that?
Oh, yeah. Make sure all the asterisks are really good colors.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to put a note somewhere else on that. Because what we really need to do is... note that these likelihood I've started accumulating a notes portion of the whole chunk of work here, and I think that's where that's going to belong. So we don't put asterisks on all these, because all of these are preliminary, I think. Okay, we knocked that one off. The next one is exactly the same, except, well, it's not exactly the same. In this case, an individual administrator changes an operational setting parameter that removes the zone server from serving the zone or publishes it incorrectly. So this is Jim's operational view of the puzzle rather than Mark's. Now hang on, folks. Let me clear our poll. All right. So now you can start voting on the range of impact of an individual administrator changing an operational parameter that removes the zone server from serving the zone or publishes it incorrectly. And the impact there starting to come in, Cheryl, in sort of the middle. Got some fives, we got some threes. People are drifting downward towards three.
Yeah,
less of an impact.
I'm going to sit in the middle of that rather than low.
Okay. Hey, Rick Wilhelm's joining the gang. Cool.
Hey, guys. Darn late.
Great to have you back.
Back, thanks.
Okay, so it's tending to drift into the three-ish zone. Okay, I think we've got to pay no attention to those numbers on the screen. Those are artifacts of the first try. So, heard this one at 1 and 6. All right. Olivier, go ahead.
Thank you, Mikey. It's Olivia for the transcript. I'm not an expert in root zone security, but I wanted to find actually root server security. I wanted to find out if anyone knows whether a misconfiguration in one of the servers could poison the others as well, or is that something that will just remain in one thanks to the checks that are being done so as to make sure it doesn't poison everything. Thank you.
I'm going to throw that on to folks who are smarter than me, that's for sure. Mark? Jim? Rick?
So configuration, we're talking about changes to like namd.conf, correct? Make sure I understand what you're saying correctly.
No, I think that was the one we talked about a minute ago. I think
okay.
That's the one that Mikey O'Connor, the inept administrator of Zone Z, the new most awful zone on the planet, screws up his server configuration somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And that can mean anything. That can mean he screws up his backups, he freezes his machine, you know, any darn thing you can imagine that knocks his machine off the air or has it start publishing, you know.
So this is Jim.
Go ahead, Jim.
And yeah, Jim Gowan. So I'll add the following comment. The thing which is making this hard for me and this question actually makes it hard too, is we keep using the word server, and yet what's interesting is, you know, for most of the root server operators, we're talking about Anycast. So the question really becomes one of, and you would have to believe, it's not a really big leap to suggest that, you know, they've got the, so you've got a set of Anycast servers, and they're probably managed in some automated or semi-automated way, which means if I make an error in a configuration file and I distribute it to my Anycast cloud, then sure, I affect the entire cloud, and that's going to have a dramatic effect. On the other hand, if for some reason something happens on an individual server, that has virtually no effect whatsoever, especially if it's monitored and detected in some way, it's taken out of service, nobody would ever notice, and you know, I mean, that kind of thing would happen. So now we get to Cheryl's comment about, you know, malicious versus accidental kind of issues, you know.
Right.
So I think it's, you know, again, this is kind of a hard question to answer because you talk about changing a zone server, but are we talking about an individual server or are we talking about an Anycast cluster of some sort? And it matters.
I think server is a Mikey word. And so because Mikey is so clueless about this stuff. And so I just changed that to zone cluster or some better word that more accurately. I mean, I think that what we are trying to get
you need the word Anycast in there. If we're going to talk about Anycast, then we should distinguish it with Anycast. That at least is a known quantity. We know what we're talking about.
And that is the not bog standard, but predominant standard that is running at the moment, is it not, Cheryl? For the record.
Yes, that's correct.
So yeah, okay.
So if we say Anycast cluster, is that a term of art that people will stand up and say, I know precisely what we're talking about, or have I still got it not quite right?
Well, I guess, you know, Mark might have certainly closer to a preferred term, but one doesn't normally talk about an Anycast cluster. Cluster is presumed when you say Anycast. So you just have an Anycast set of servers. I don't know if Mark has a preferred term there for that, but
how about if I start trying to describe it? Maybe we can come up with a term that makes sense. Some of the root servers themselves are not Anycast, and they're all identified by labels. So A is now it's Anycast, but it wasn't. B used to not be Anycast. G, for example, is not Anycast. So and they're all, for the most part, administrated separately. So I guess
what if we took Anycast out and said, I mean, now I'm really hedging the language, but I think this language is really important. What if we said an individual administrator changes an operational parameter that removes the zone servers / cloud / cluster from serving the zone or publishes it incorrectly? That would work.
If you go to rootservers.org, they actually label it as server, which is and underneath each server, they talk about the number of locations you have.
Rick, by the way, you should just dive in. You should not be so darn polite. I know that you're a really polite guy, but this is clearly not a polite conversation.
The coffee hasn't kicked in yet, so I'm still in polite mode. So this is Rick Wilhelm. I think that probably here we're concerned with whether or not the zone is being published correctly or incorrectly, right? And correctly is fully correctly, and incorrectly means any or all of it is uttering incorrect answers or not uttering answers at all. So largely, probably you could almost, instead of saying servers, cloud, cluster, you just say removes the zone from being published or is published incorrectly. And how that happens is, as Mark points out, a lot dependent on which root server we're talking about. So, for what it's worth, and then on a kind of winding, popping the stack a little bit, the AnyCast cluster is sort of a pretty commonly used term of art. Not only in my sort of personal discourse, but also I did a little Googling, and you see those two words juxtaposed against each other more often than not. Sometimes these days they're called cloud, but that's perhaps a little bit too trendy for old school DNS folk.
Yeah, trendy. I just got a great new domain, cloudmikey.com, which is where my Apple server sits. So how's the language looking now? We said an individual administrator changes an operational parameter that removes the zone from being published or publishes it incorrectly. That getting pretty honed in? That neatly avoids all that language about AnyCast so that we don't have to...
Yeah, and I would say that the likelihood of something like that might be varying based on the points that both Jim and Mark made about the use of AnyCast versus Unicast and a particular operator's, root operator's implementation and how they do it. The impact is, the likelihood of that happening is largely dependent on how the person does it, their operator does it. That was Rick, by the way. Sorry.
Thanks, Rick. I'm typing this. So put that note. I think our likelihood conversation is starting to devolve into maybe this one happens later when we get to controls. But I think this is a great place to put these notes for now. And then we'll... The one thing I don't want to do is lose a key thought. Oh, Rosella just published a link, Technical Requirements for Authoritative Name Servers, from IANA. I'll grab that one, too. For the notes... Thanks, Rosella. Oops. All right. So it seems like we've got good language, and we've got a range of impact that ranges sort of in the middle. Does anybody want to change your range vote before I record them, given this clarifying conversation we had? Speak now, or better yet, change now, and then I'll pound these results into the spreadsheet. Okay. Good deal. I think we're doing a great job, although we may be at this job until... the year 2020, but I think this is really really good stuff. Okay, so let's see. We've done the root, yes, I think. Yes, we've done that one. So let's pick off one more if we can. We've got about 8 or 9 minutes to go. One of the configuration errors that popped up was the configuration of a major DNSSEC provider. And this is one that I just sort of heard in conversation, so I sort of, just as before, sort of rattled it into the list. I think we probably need a little conversation about this one before we do our ratings, because... again, this is one where we probably want to clarify the description. And again, I'm totally clueless. Are the DNSSEC providers typically the same as the organizations that host zone files, major, you know, TLD zone files, or are they more like DNS providers where they can be completely independent? I just don't know the architecture very well. Anybody want to give us a small tutorial on DNSSEC and how it works? I'm looking to Jim or Rick or Mark or any of those smart folks.
So this is Jim, a small tutorial?
Yeah, a small tutorial.
Okay, let's see. You get a key, you sign your zone, and then people validate, and you're good to go.
Okay, that's good. So does that mean that there is no such thing as an independent third-party provider of DNSSEC services? It's all bound up in the zone file conversation end-to-end?
Hi, this is Ray.
Well, no, that's not true. I mean, you can even look at what VeriSign is doing now with respect to providing a bump-in-the-wire kind of service, right? I mean,
You
can just ship their zone file to them, they'll sign it, and they'll ship it back to you, and then you get to publish it however you would like to. And they're not the only ones who have that kind of service, but, you know, theirs is probably the most significant. So you
can,
you can just have a third party.
The third party's, the service that they're providing is generating the keys and then handing a file back to you, which then gets published whatever way it was getting published before. But now it's got the DNSSEC keys, correct?
I mean, I still think the dominant configuration is that your signing is done by your operator, and those two things tend to be tightly coupled. I still think that's the way it's primarily done today, but it's hard to say where all of that's going to go. You know, I wouldn't even want to venture a guess as to what the most popular, if you will, configuration is going to be somewhere down the road. So, I'm not sure what question you were asking. You know, whoever's going to sign your zone, they would have the key. Whoever's signing the zone would typically control the key. I mean, from a security point of view, that would really be the only way that you would do it. Now, whether or not they publish your zone for you or they're just providing a service where you give them a zone and they hand you back a signed zone, that's just a distinction in service, right?
Market hasn't really evolved to that state yet. Right now, if you're capable of hosting a signed zone, you're probably capable of signing a zone. Would you say that's fair, Jim?
Well, you're certainly eligible to sign the zone if you're hosting it. But I think that not everyone who hosts signs, and that's really kind of the issue that we have today, isn't it?
Right. Not everyone who hosts signs, but everyone that signs hosts. And most of the time, if you've got the wherewithal to host a signed zone, you also have the wherewithal to sign the zone. In other words, I haven't seen anybody that will host a signed zone for you that won't also sign it for you. Right? Or anybody that could host a sign, like a private person or a company that is capable of hosting a signed zone is almost always, and I haven't seen anybody that isn't also capable of generating that signature themselves. You know, the high order term in the equation, I would say, is doing the signing, the higher term in the equation is being able to do all the hosting and associated with the signing and things like that, not the actual signing itself. Once you get that wired up, that seems pretty straightforward.
So I think that the question on the table, and maybe what we need to do,
Mark,
given that we're 4 minutes from the end.
There.
Oh, yeah. Mark wrote in the chat, VeriSign has seen very little demand on their bump-in-the-wire DNSSEC service. That's the one where you hand a zone to them, they sign it, and hand it back, right?
That is correct.
I think what we need to do between now and next week is ponder what kind of configuration error we want to describe in this DNSSEC blob, if any, and who does it. This is a really interesting conversation that why don't we just all sort of mentally take a homework assignment? And my sort of lame chair question to the rest of us is, what can a privileged user in a DNSSEC environment do to wreck things, to break stuff,
and see
if we can describe that. And then we'll pick the conversation up at that point.
And that, Cheryl here, that's going to get us into the we need to decide what we need to put in the control points part of this analysis and make sure we're certain what we're discussing at this point in the analysis.
Right. Yeah. I am starting to realize why the methodology restricted us the way it did, and I'm going to think a little bit about that. I think, again, what we're going to have to do is sort of a preliminary pass. You can see why they do these analyses over and over again, because the first time you do it, you sort of clear out brush and do a lot of hard slogging on terminologies and so on and so forth. But then coming back through it again gives us the chance to sort of refine this. And I think what we'll have to do is park the controls discussion.
Good thing, Mark. Yeah, I don't feel my time's wasted with this, because we're trying to ascertain where the critical control points are and what risks can be associated with those.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think this is really useful. I just hope people have the patience to live through it. I sure am glad that we don't have a deadline in our charter.
Well,
okay.
Yeah.
That's it for today, folks. It's coming up on the top of the hour. I really appreciate all the help and conversation. This is getting to the fun part of the conversation. We're not doing process. We're doing really interesting content, and certainly I'm learning a lot during the course of it. So I look forward to seeing you in a week, although I will not be on the call next week. So you co-chair types, we need to figure out how we're going to handle the call a week from today, because I have to go to a public hearing on frac sand mining in my rural district. So with that, I'll see the rest of you in 2 weeks, and have a great day.
Thanks, Mikey.
I think that's the recording.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye. Thanks.